Hello, everybody. Dr. Lonnie Stewart here from the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. Are you a physical therapy student about to start studying for the National Physical Therapy Examination? Or maybe you're a professor, a program director, or a clinical instructor who teaches DPT students preparing for the NPTE? Either way, we would recommend checking out our sponsor, NPTE Final Frontier, and the community they've built around preparing for and succeeding on the NPTE. That exam and the preparation that goes along with it can be long, tedious, difficult, and stress-inducing, but it doesn't have to be. NPTE Final Frontier has the tactics and resources to help address all of the usual barriers. They even have scholarships to help with NPTE study courses, FSBPT registration fees, and even research opportunities. And if that's not enough, they're even donating to the very first annual HET Podcast Scholarship to be awarded at the end of every year. Go to npteff.com for all of the details and use code HET for 10% off all purchases. Links to both the NPTE Final Frontier and their scholarship options are available in the show notes. And now, let's get ready to learn.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. F. Scott Field. And I've got with me today a fun guest. I'm kind of like a kid in a candy shop when I get to sit and chat with entrepreneurship about anybody. But Dr. Toby Brooks has agreed to join us today and talk a little bit about an interesting topic in academia, to say the least. Toby, thanks so much for joining us, man. Tell us a little bit about your academic journey and how it's led you to where you're at today.
Well, Scott, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. Been a longtime follower of your work, so a little surreal to be on this side. I am the program director of the Masters of Athletic Training Program at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in Lubbock, Texas. Just got promoted to full professor formally the first of this month. So long time journey to get there. I also serve as our assistant dean of faculty success. So I do quite a bit on the kind of the development space and trying to help in particular clinicians that have long served in clinical practice and make the jump into the classroom to hopefully do a better job teaching. So I've been in academia kind of back and forth, kind of bounced between clinical practice and teaching for several years, but I've been here at Texas Tech for 14, the last 14. And it's been great. Really enjoyed the growth opportunities and the programming that we have here. And it's been quite a journey.
Yeah, that jump from clinical to academia is no joke, man. I thought, I have had my EDD since 2018. Went right back into clinical after that because the dissertation burnt me out. And I just thought when I was ready to teach, I could just jump right into it and teach. But it is a legit transformation. I mean, it is a whole new job. It's a career change for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a little surreal. I mean, here in Texas, I couldn't teach kindergarten. I'm not licensed. I hadn't spent time in the classroom. But yet we have professors who are teaching PhD students who have never had a pedagogy course. They've never had any formal training on how to write a test question. So we kind of have the thing flipped upside down. So it's kind of my passion to come alongside those people because more often than not, they want to do a good job in the classroom. It just wasn't part of their preparation. And so in-service programming and fellowships and things of that nature that are intended to help folks level up as they go have really been the focus of my work in particular the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. I love that. We need more of that because like you said, I've seen a ton of PhDs who have no idea how to teach. They're brilliant researchers, probably, brilliant clinicians. They just don't know how to teach. So having a PhD doesn't mean you know how to teach. That being said, having an EDD doesn't necessarily mean you're a content or a topic expert or know how to teach either. So, I mean, I like to think that the EDD helped me tremendously learn how to both learn and teach. So that's been, phenomenal for me to have that DPT clinical experience, but also the EDD for education. So that's worked out for me, but not everybody has that same track, Sure. All right, let's dive into the meat and potatoes of today's episode. This is something, again, like I said, I get giddy when I get to talk about this because I can talk business and entrepreneurship all day, every day. I love it. I eat, sleep, and drink it. But also got to kind of figure out ways to tie it back into, DPT stuff, healthcare in general. And I've kind of found some ways to do that. But I'd love to hear first your take on academia and its thoughts and feelings on business and entrepreneurship.
And I think it's gotten better. That's a great question. It has certainly improved during my 20 years on the academic side, but there's still kind of this stigma. There's almost some shame, or like you have to creep around in order to have any kind of an entrepreneurial mindset, especially at a state institution. And that's really too bad. In athletic training in particular, we probably suffer from this more so than even in PT, because there aren't a lot of cash for services, third-party billing being what it is. ATs don't oftentimes own their own places. So in PT, that's not unprecedented. And you need some business chops. You need to understand billing and marketing and all the things that go into running a successful and profitable business. In athletic training, frequently we're hired maybe in clinics that are private, but we don't frequently own them. But more frequently, we're in a school district, or we're at a college or a university, or with a professional sports team. And so the business side, we just kind of leave that to other people. And I teach business and organization in our curriculum. And it's interesting that even at the graduate level, as a master's student, a lot of times our students kind of don't really appreciate the business side. Like they're training to be someone else's employee. The notion of being my own business owner, or understanding the inner workings of having a profitable business, isn't something that they're frequently interested in. And my hope is through the course, they start to develop that. However, we've really seen a transition, I think. So I've done NSF I-Corps 6 times on the regional level now, and once on the national level. And if you're not familiar with it, it's a National Science Foundation program that's intended to take innovations that have bubbled up in colleges and universities. Say an engineer develops a new material and they don't know what to do with it. So NSF I-Corps is a formal program that allows you to do several weeks, and in the case of the national, several months of customer discovery. And you figure out, is this a commercializable idea? Is there any chance that this could form a successful business? And then at that point, if the answer is yes, then we look for investors. If the answer is no, hey, it was a good process, but we haven't wasted a lot of time and money pursuing an answer that doesn't have a problem yet. And so I find in the health sciences, we almost shy away from, we turn our nose at business and entrepreneurship. Like somehow it's antithetical to the higher purposes of being in healthcare. But the reality is, if I can help my institution be successful from a business standpoint, then that helps increase our reach. And without a margin, there's no mission. And I really believe that having a bit of an entrepreneurial mindset and constantly looking for ways to innovate is really fundamental in what we do. It's not something we should shy away from. It's something we should embrace with both arms. So it's been hard. I mean, you know as well as I do, if you have that entrepreneurial mindset, sometimes you feel like you are not among your people when you're in faculty meetings or talking to administrators, because somehow it's counter to the nonprofit purpose of most institutions. And you know, the for-profit institutions of the world are somehow shady, or they're diabolical. They're just looking to make a buck. And that doesn't have to be it at all. It really is about, is this a sustainable model? And can we reach more people? And it takes profit to do that.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, first off, yeah, I agree. I feel like business and academia are like oil and water. You know, they just don't mix. Now, that being said, business, not just business, I mean, healthcare in general and education are moving more and more and more towards business and socialism on a daily basis. So like, we've started one of the innovative ways we've tried to kind of to do that, because in our DPT program, I teach the business and admin course as well. And it's a little bit antiquated. It kind of seems like back when I took, when I started in PT, it was a master's program. And we had a business course, and essentially everybody had to do the same project. You get a, you know, 50,000 square foot gym and $100,000 business loan, and, you know, start your business. And it's like, well, all right, not a lot of people do that, first off. Second off, there's so many different business models now that can work that you don't need that kind of stuff. And nobody goes out and gets like $100,000 business loan to start a PT practice. I mean, it can be done, but it's just not normal. And on top of that, it's like, even if, you know, we look at the NPTE exam, there's probably one or two questions on business and admin on the exam. So it's not that important, but they still need to know some of it, right? You need to know about Medicare and billing and how that all works. And so one of the innovative ways we've tried to incorporate it is we started a business entrepreneurs and private practice student special interest group, right? This is outside of class time. This is extra, you know, a student special interest group that meets once a month, you know, virtually and everybody's welcome to the meetings. And it's not just PT, it's OT, speech, and nurse practitioner, and PA, and all the other programs we have. But even if you don't want to start a business or a, you know, your own practice, you still have to know the business of healthcare and how it works in order to negotiate a contract, in order to understand what the perks are and the benefits are to working for different, because you could have a job that offers you $100,000, but no other perks. And you could have a job that maybe offers you $80,000, but APTA dues are done, your license is covered, CEUs, $5,000 a year, great 401k, great benefits and health benefits. Like, those aren't the same, you know? And they have to at least know how the business of healthcare works and how we get paid. I mean, even if you look at the traditional model, which is awful in my own opinion, but reimbursement's not going up. I mean, it's going down. It's not going to, you know, all of a sudden miraculously turn around and go up. So like, you need to understand how your paycheck is getting, you know, paid out. Mm-hmm. And as of right now, most of it's through reimbursement model. So if you at least understand that, that'll at least hopefully help you to make better decisions when it comes to which job I'm going to take, which contract I'm going to accept. And with the student loan crisis, I'll call it, getting worse, no, the debt to income ratio in healthcare is getting bad. I mean, in PT world, it's not good. It's not bad. I mean, it's not great, you know, and it's only going to get worse. So you mentioned the difference between private and public universities, but realistically, I mean, I've seen some state schools that have lazy rivers and, you know, these multi-million dollar workout training rooms for teams and stuff. So you tell me that they're not in the business of making money, you know, I mean, It's a tough pill to swallow sometimes, but at the end of the day, it's business, man. It's money.
I think along those same lines, for those of us in academia, a lot of traditional funding sources are really drying up. And if you're a tenure track professor and you're expected to land grant money, that's probably as hard as it's ever been. I mean, local and internal grants may be okay, but it's really difficult to build yourself as a grant funded person. However, what we've discovered through our NSFI core work is funding and innovation space is really growing. And the NSF has poured a lot of money to the tune of millions of dollars into innovation programming. So for instance, every time I've done that regional I-Corps, that's a $5,000 award. I've done that six times. That's 30K. Well, that's not tremendous for if I'm a physics researcher, but in the health sciences, anything's good. At the national level, that's a $50,000 federal award. It's competitive, but it's certainly not the same as an R1, you know, an R1 grant would be, or even some of the more regional awards. The idea of doing science for science's sake really doesn't benefit society like it could. So this idea of innovation and turning that into commercialization really has a net positive effect for society. What good does it do if I'm researching a new material if I publish it in a dissertation or it's in a journal article that no one ever reads, but instead it turns into this new wearable technology that people can purchase and use on the weekends when they're working out. I mean, the commercialization space is kind of blue ocean compared to the more traditional models that are drying up.
Yeah, I love that take. And, you know, I like something you kind of touched on earlier in the episode where you said, look, it's getting better, right? They're becoming more aware. It's becoming more accepted. And I see that. I do. I really do. Because one of the things that I think we need more of is like the NSFI options and the you know, student special interest groups and these business incubators that can help people at the very least bring awareness to how they can leverage their authority, their expertise, and their degrees, right? Like, we have the letters after our name. We have all this alphabet soup after our name. You're an expert in something, right? You wouldn't have got to this level in academia if you weren't. They don't just pick random people and say, hey, go teach this class. In order to get to that point, you have life experience, you have credentials, you have licenses, you have that alphabet soup after your name. Why not leverage it into something, some form of business to get paid what you're worth, what your value is for doing what you're already really good at?
Yeah, that old model was really kind of either or, where I'm either going to be a professor or I'm going to resign my position and I'm going to go pursue something in private industry. And what universities have recognized is they're shooting themselves in the foot by doing that. If the university already has legal, they've already got maybe a trademarks and intellectual properties expert, they've already got that in-house. Why not okay, fill out this conflict of interest form. Let's establish who owns what up front. And if you want to own it all, then you're going to have to pay for that, that, you know, the legal work to trademark it and patent it. If we pay for it, fine, but we'll take a cut of it. And then if that professor stays there through their career and 20 years of licensing, the university has benefited. The professor's benefited. They don't feel like, you know, they have to do things on nights and weekends. And it really does benefit all involved. And I look at programs like Purdue, where they look to fill out hundreds of conflict of interest forms every year. They're like, if we're not innovating, then we are dying. Whereas other kind of old traditional models would be, well, if you're pursuing your business interests, then you've got a conflict of commitment and you're not interested in your job and you're neglecting, you're being derelict in your duties. And it doesn't have to be that binary. There really can be a sweet spot in between where I can still pursue my passions, but I'm benefiting the university in doing it.
1,000%. I could not agree more. I put in probably 40, 45 hours a week for the university because I do. I love teaching. I love my job. I love what I do. But I also put in an extra 15 to 20 on my side business because I love that too. I love teaching and coaching and educating on business and helping people, you know, pay down their student loans quicker, helping people get out from under that student loan debt, you know, that crushing pressure of the debt. I love it. I live to do this stuff. It is easily the thing that gets me up out of bed every day. So, you know, if there's a university that's not willing to work with you on that, then I question, you know, whether or not it's a great fit, you know, if that's something you're truly interested in. But I do like the idea of the innovative, you know, universities trying to push the envelope and saying, hey, it's your world, man. Go out there and do your thing. Like, to me, that's a draw. I would go to a university like that. Plus, I like to see universities that are pushing the envelope a little bit and that are, you know, letting professors be rock stars and superstars, right? Let them go out there. Let them make a living. Let them, you know, show off their expertise. Like, that's good press for you. I mean, that just makes sense, you know? So, Toby, let me ask you this. Like, what's your why behind entrepreneurship and business? Like, what got you interested in it? What makes you excited about it? Because I know, and follow-up question, why should people in academia pursue entrepreneurship and business? Because I know for me, like, it, you know, it was a no-brainer. And the answer to the question of like, well, what should I do most of the time is start your own business, you know? I hate to say that, but it's either make more money. All right, well, how do you do that? Well, you start your own business. You know, you could work PRN in extra hours, but you're still trading time for money. So what was your why? What got you started? What got you going on that? And then why should people pursue it?
Love the question. I'm a first-generation college student. My dad was a coal miner growing up and a mechanic. He worked on heavy diesel equipment. And I learned at an early age, he worked a lot of weekends and overtime. In the coal industry, you got it while you could because there was never a guarantee that, you know, he was laid off frequently during my childhood. There were months where he would go without being employed. And I just learned at an early age that if I want to make something happen, then that's within my capacity. And I'm not going to stick my hand out and ask for more. I'm going to try to figure out a way to work for more. I got sent to the principal's office every year from probably third grade until I got my driver's license, because I would buy candy at Walmart for 33 cents for like a Reese's cup and pack it in my bag and then sell it on the bus. And I would always get in trouble because, well, we got school fundraisers and, you know, you're cutting into the business of you're not supposed to sell things on the bus. And I remember like every year I'd kind of wait and then, all right, I'm going to start this business. And it was like secretive, like, hey, you want to buy some candy? And it became profitable. And I kind of learned the ins and outs of margin, and I learned how to inventory and, you know, this is selling well and this isn't. And so I just learned at that early age that if I'm going to be successful, it's up to me to figure out ways to iterate that. In college, I worked three jobs. I worked at a pizza place. I worked at a grocery store. I was a car stereo installer. When I got into athletic training, I worked one job, but it was like 80 hours a week, you know, 7 days a week. And so my ability to really pursue side hustles or these other careers really kind of came when I finally decided it started back up when I left full-time clinical practice, because working 40 hours a week felt like I was working half time. And I'm like, what am I going to do with the rest of my time? And so I've been an art director for a magazine for 8 years, car magazine, wrote features and did things there. I've written several books. Oftentimes, you know, that was kind of a fee for service. And that's when it's really beautiful, is if you can find a side hustle that also helps build your career forward and establish you as an expert in a field, then that's even better. And so for me, it really boiled down to what I saw modeled by my dad, this idea that if you want it, work for it. And then just this notion that sometimes you're going to have to find a way. And like you said, education isn't getting cheaper. What students are graduating with, this crushing student loan debt, isn't getting smaller. And so it's almost become a necessity, either dual income households, or I need to find a side hustle. Otherwise, I'm going to spend my entire career. I used to be amazed by this. I was at Liberty University for a year. I've talked with students who've gone to Rice or gone to Baylor. So they go to these private schools and they'll routinely graduate with 150K in debt or more with a teaching degree. And I'm not trying to dunk on teachers. I love educators, but it just dawned on me, like, you spent 4 or 5 years to earn this degree and you're going to spend the rest of your career to pay off the privilege that you earned. It felt wrong to me. And so this idea that we could liberate people and get them out from under that debt through things they love to do that feed into their passion, I'm all in, man. I absolutely love it.
Yeah. So I have a similar kind of path there. My dad was an English teacher, right, for many years up on Long Island, hence the name F. Scott, right? But he also had a landscaping business in the summers when he was off from teaching, right? He owned it throughout the year, but his partner took it over most of the time when he was during the year and he was teaching. So I, kind of got a view into entrepreneurship early on in my life. My brother and I sold golf balls on the 10th hole of a golf course that we'd go out and find the night before and clean up, right? Same thing. We learned margin. We learned what was selling, what wasn't, you know, and had to run our own little business there. We had all the money we needed for the summer. It was great. But yeah, once you kind of move ahead and you look at these things in hindsight, I probably would have went to, you know, community college for 2 years and then state school for all the rest of my years. I was dumb about it. I did go to private schools and luckily it's worked out. I've leveraged the doctoral degrees, you know, fairly well. But I think one of the key things you said there is that all these learning experiences and these things that you can do and these side hustles and side things, it's really just stacking skills that are going to make you, like you said, that expert and authority later on in your career. And you'll know how to do things that other people who aren't doing this stuff and hustling, they just won't know. For instance, when I started my cash pay business, I was a mobile PT practice driving around treating people like in the Waco area there. I didn't know how to run ads. I didn't know how to run Facebook ads. I knew that they existed and I knew that they worked, but I didn't know. I tried once or twice and failed miserably, got no patience from it. I was like, all right, I don't know what I'm doing here. So I invested in a course, right? The course was $5,000. I was like, no, it's a pretty big investment. Let's see what happens. But within the first week of running those new ads that the course taught me, I got 3 new patients, which were worth a lifetime value of about, you know, $2,000-$3,000 each if they filled out their plan of care. So the first 3 patients were $6,000. Course was $5,000. There's $1,000 in profit. Then every other patient I got from there on out was worth it. You know, so it is a mindset shift and you have to be willing to invest in yourself, I think, more than anything. You know, but like I said, I just, to me, the answer most of the time is to start your own business. At the very least, even if it's just barely profitable, you get a tax break on the write-offs on all the stuff you need for the business. So that helps, right? It kind of helps lower your overall salary if you're able to, you know, come up with the write-offs that kind of help with that. But like at the end of the day, it's like, if you need more money, you've got to make more money. And if you've got to find a way, then starting your own business gives you that option. And now for a quick shout out to our newest sponsor, Varela Financial. If you're a physical therapist and you have student loan debt, you got to talk to these guys. What makes them unique is that they view financial planning like running hurdles on a track. And for PTs, the first hurdle many of us run into is student loan debt. Varela Financial will help you get over that hurdle. They not only take the time to explain to you which plans you individually qualify for and how those plans work, but they also take the time to show you what your individual case looks like, mapped out within each option. So if you're looking for help on your student loan debt or any area of personal finances, we recommend working with them. I use Varela Financial personally, and they were able to help me lower my student loan repayment from about $1,800 a month down to about $135 per month simply by finding the right repayment plan that best fit me,
my family, and our life goals. You can check them out at VarellaFinancial.com. Link is in the show notes if you need it for reference, and tell them the HET podcast crew sent you. And now, back to the show.
It's also helped me develop a better relationship with fear, because I said I was an art director for a magazine. I had a friend who bought, he acquired a title, and he's like, okay, I'm gonna do this little local magazine. Would you be willing to do the art? I knew how to use Photoshop at that time. I don't remember who said it, but an entrepreneurship book I read a long time ago said, answer yes and figure it out later. And so I answered yes, and I had never even used Adobe InDesign before. And so watching YouTube videos in this day and age, I probably would have gone to Coursera. People have so many resources. That 5K, you've got skin in the game, so you're going to do what needs to be done to be successful. And sometimes I feel like that in and of itself is a benefit, because if it's free, it didn't cost me anything. Sometimes I'm not so good on the follow through. So whether it's a free Coursera course or watching YouTube videos or connecting with a mentor that knows what they're doing, sometimes free means I don't take it as seriously as I should. But that said, you know, I was afraid and I learned how to do it. Podcasting was the same thing. I'd never used a digital audio workstation before. I didn't know how to set up a microphone. All those things that you figure out along the way, man, those are so cool and so critical to patient care. You know, like if my patient isn't responding to my plan of care, the old me would have probably just referred them out. And that's, you know, let's see what the doc says. But an entrepreneur mindset says, we're going to find a way. We're going to try a different route. Success depends on what I do. It depends on the effort that I put forth in it. And so I think a lot of times there's a cushion in higher education where, you know, we might build this new program, and if it's not successful, there's a lot of other programs and they'll probably subsidize it and keep us running for however long we want to keep it. But my family's ability to eat tonight isn't depending on me being successful. And that makes us a little complacent, I think. Whereas the entrepreneurial mindset says, if I don't win, I don't eat. And I love that. I love the pressure of feeling like I have to level up or I'm not going to be successful. Those side hustles, those other gigs, they teach you new skills along the way that you can use in the day-to-day job. I'm right on the threshold. Like I'm comfortable enough with this podcasting thing that our program needs one. We're thinking about using podcasting to communicate with our preceptors, because the younger generation doesn't want to read emails. It's not always convenient to text. So maybe we'll try a little 5 to 10 minute podcast that they can listen to on their way in to communicate what we're doing. That makes me a better employee.
Yeah, we presented on podcasting in higher education back in 2018 at Educational Learning Conference, the APTA's ELC, and it's not quite there yet. It's on the cusp. The only thing we really need to break through, I think, is some sort of like peer-reviewed platform or something that'll help say, yes, this is a validated podcast, good for references. Have at it. You know, the information is validated. That's about it. And I think we're close. We're getting there. But yeah, man, you bring up another good point there. Like all those things that you learn along the way, right? It's problem solving. It's critical thinking. That entrepreneurial mind just keeps working and keeps trying to figure things out. And if you don't, like you said, if the patient doesn't respond, that's not failure. That's the first attempt in learning, right? That's the, I tried, it didn't work. Let's try something else. Let's try something else. And let's keep going until we figure it out, you know? And those little experiences and those things picked up along the way, even like starting a podcast, like you said, like even if you don't like portions of it, you have to know how it works. You have to roll up your sleeves and get in the trenches and actually do the work to see what's required so that you can then outsource it. If you don't like it, that's totally fine. Like right now for Facebook ads, I don't do that anymore because I don't like it. I outsource it, but I needed to know who to outsource and what to outsource. So I had to get in there and roll up the sleeves and figure it out first.
And that was liberating for me. One podcast I listened to for a long time is Lewis Howe's School of Greatness. And I had kind of picked it up. He's 1,000+ episodes deep now. And I think I started listening somewhere in the 800, 900 range. And I had never worked back. And when I said, I wouldn't mind having a podcast of my own, I'm going to go back and listen to his first one. It sounds like it was recorded in a bathroom on a potato. Like
this podcast the same way. First 10, 15 episodes are garbage.
But that's the beauty of learning. And the difference is, you know, I'm old enough that social media wasn't around and everybody didn't have a camera in their pocket when I was first learning clinical skills. It'd be cool to be able to go back and look at how far I've come.
Yeah.
That's what this allows you to do. You get to kind of leave breadcrumbs to show yourself when you feel like, man, this thing isn't growing at the rate I want it to. It's disappointing. I've even documented how many listens episodes have at certain milestones, because growth has a way of kind of callousing us to where we've come from. And seeing that for now, you know what, if I drop an episode, a certain number might be disappointing. But if I look at what that was doing in January, that's 3X or it's 5X of what I was doing then. And so it really allows you to give yourself a little grace. And I think the key is consistency. Just be comfortable with sucking at it for a while. And that's how expertise is built. It doesn't have to be, you know, for me, perfectionism is a robber of dreams. And if I can get over that innate desire for it to be perfect, then I can move forward. But it will paralyze you if you expect to be at, I'm never going to be at Lewis Howe's level at episode 800 in my first one. But if I go back to listen to his first one and my first one, I think mine's better.
Yeah, because we got to stand on the shoulders of giants and see how it's done, right?
Exactly. I heard a great quote today. Whose podcast was it? I don't remember who it was, but he talked about how a lot of times small-minded people, they'll discredit people who are successful. He talked about how an end cap in his store had Prime, the Jake Paul brand of energy drink. And he said, you know, people can't stand him. But this is a young guy and his brother who have turned this into a billion-dollar industry, right? And he said, instead of hating them and resenting their success, they've left breadcrumbs of what they've done to be successful. And like you said, we can leverage mistakes that they learned the hard way and accelerate our learning curve so that hopefully we can get there faster.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of mentorship and paid mentorship and coaching, because again, I don't know it and I know they do. So I'm willing to pay for their time to show me, and B, it condenses our timeline and speed things up. And that's one thing that entrepreneurs, I think for the most part, don't have too much of a problem doing. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for either consulting or the answer to this issue or how to speed up the timeline. So they're willing to pay for mentorship and coaching because it's just worth it in the end. The time it would take me to learn this skill via YouTube and trying it and doing it, it's just not worth it. So I'm going to pay somebody to speed this up, and that'll just get it off my plate. I'll know how to do it. I'll have the skill, and boom, now we're on to the next thing, and I'm still making money, and I'm probably making more than I was when I first paid for the thing in the first place.
It's like the adoption of technology. If a third world country is just developing their communication systems, they're not going to go back in time and distribute manual typewriters and old landlines to people. That's proven to be an antiquated technology. It's kind of the same idea where they're just going to go straight to wireless. They've stepped over what was for our country 70 or 80 years of slow progress, and they can catch up right away. And entrepreneurship can be very much the same, whether it's systems, whether it is software, whether it is just an approach. And that's where constantly reading and listening to podcasts, and it has helped me tremendously, because otherwise, all you have is all you have, and you're not able to grow from there.
Well, and I think too, like, we have these skill sets that have gotten us this far in life. We've gotten through all these degrees and all these, you know, tests and certifications and all this stuff. And you don't even realize that you have some of these skill sets, like soft skills, communication, networking, prioritization, ability to like focus and study and like organize things for like tests and for courses and stuff like that. So like, we already have these skills. We learned them all along the way to get to where we're at now. Now it's just a matter of like implementing, you know? And I think that that's the difference a lot of times, is like, especially in academia, professors and you know, the like, are, well, I'm not really sure how to do it. Like, I didn't know how to do it. I just implemented. I started trying stuff. Just start trying. And eventually, it's like Alex Hormozi said, if you try the same thing enough, long enough, over and over and over, and you work on it, you really craft it, you make it your skill, it's ridiculous to think that you won't be successful at it at some point.
Yeah. I heard it described like this. A lot of times we in academia are kind of trained, if we see a target and we want to do it, it's ready, aim. And entrepreneurs are ready, fire, aim. Right. And it's about action and it's about iteration and feeding what works well and starving what's proven not to work well. And I think that has a natural spillover into the day job. And that can help us build programs that people want to pursue. And it can help us publish research that people want to read instead of kind of this dogged adherence to tradition. And I don't mean to poo-poo that, but a lot of times we can be our own worst enemies with this idea that we have to do it this certain slow, methodical, you know, nothing moves slower than a state entity, this massive bureaucracy.
Yeah. And that's one of the issues I have with academia in general. It's just the politics and the red tape and the bureaucracy, because I get it. It's a big ship and it takes time to move and turn and alter the course, but entrepreneurs don't really think that way. And I think, you know, the people that are going to solve the big problems are already doing it. They're entrepreneurs, you know. I think that's a little bit where the oil and water kind of comes in, where, you know, academia is a little bit stuffy and entrepreneurs don't have time for that, you know. So it's definitely been a delicate balance for me of trying to, you know, keep one foot in each boat. But at the same time, the work that I'm doing on the side and helping people find their zone of genius, find their thing they're really good at and that they're an expert and authority in, and turning that into a business, to me, that's worth it. You know, it's worth it to take my lumps and do what I got to do in academia to help show those people how to do it.
It's interesting because I launched the podcast. I actually interviewed a former doc student who he's a really successful researcher, but during COVID, he got laid off and he said, you know, I'm not doing anything. I'll go get my MBA. And so he ends up getting his MBA, gets a new position once out of COVID. And from that conversation, it just planted a seed. It's like the Morpheus quote, like the splinter in your mind. It's like MBA. Like for so long, I'm like, well, I've got the street cred. I've been doing business. I don't need a master's degree in business administration. I've got experience. And I just couldn't shake this idea. And so I started pursuing, looking into accredited programs and stuff. And so now I'm, by the end of Christmas, I'll be halfway done with an MBA. I'm on my third course now. And I've learned so much that sometimes I innately knew, but a lot of times I just didn't. Like pricing structures, there is a science to that. It's not just a stab in the dark. Like, you know, well, if I bought it for 33 cents, I sell it for 50. That's good because they carry quarters. That's a pretty simple pricing structure for a 10-year-old, but now that I own a business and I'm trying to sell stuff out of the shop, then it's more elegant than that. We've got eBay fees and merchant account. I mean, there's just so much more that goes into it.
Okay.
And so we as academics have been trained, like if you want to do something, you need a degree to do that. Entrepreneurs oftentimes go the far opposite end. Like you don't need any degrees at all. You can Coursera yourself or YouTube yourself or just fail your way to success. This has kind of proven to me that I'm kind of a best of both worlds guy. Like I want the experience and the street cred to do it, but there's no replacement for me for book learning. So I would like to think that this is going to make me better in both regards, better in the classroom teaching my students and also better in terms of being an entrepreneur.
Well, I mean, again, I think a lot of us at this point, if you get to this point in academia, you're a dork, you know, you're a geek, and I'll own that. I'm a lifelong learner and I love it. Like I love reading, I love listening, I love consuming knowledge. The shift and the difference is that implementation. It's like, all right, great, you've learned, I could read 100 books on business. So if I don't do anything with it, it's useless, you know? So I think that's the key differentiator there is you got to take action. You got to just get out there and like Nike says, right? Just do it. Right? Because that's how you're going to learn. That's how you're going to become successful. You know? Well, Toby, I have another question for you. What advice would you give to somebody who might be in academia and wants to start a business? They want to get started. They have no idea where to start. What kind of advice would you give to somebody in that situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. Here at our institution, we have, it's called the Hub. It's the Innovation and Business Development Center. Many institutions will have, whether it's a small business development center or a business incubator, those are the kinds of people you want to align yourself with because they talk a different language than you're probably hearing in your faculty meetings. And their timelines are certainly dramatically different than what you're probably used to in your administrative meetings. And so if those resources are available, use them. Oftentimes they're free or they may be inexpensive, maybe some costs involved. If your university or your college doesn't have those resources, then sometimes within the community, there may be resources like that as well. Whether it's a regional small business development center that's not affiliated with an institution. But I think those are logical places. And then find a mentor, someone preferably that is, they don't have to be an athletic trainer for me, but someone in nursing would be a more logical connection for me than someone in physics or chemistry. And so having that mentor that you can rely on is another valuable process. I've also seen just these massive, I forget what Coursera refers to itself as, but these open platforms where you can learn just about any skill you want to learn free or inexpensively. During COVID, we signed up for a masterclass. There are business and leadership and entrepreneurship courses on there that are really, really good mindset courses. The most recent one I did was a Mike Krzyzewski course on leadership and communication. Just never stop learning. And the moment we get complacent is the moment we start to get outdated. And I find that if I rest on my laurels, the pace of innovation keeps going. And so every passing day means I'm further behind. So like we said, we're trying to innovate ways that we can communicate with our preceptors because they're younger than I remember them being. And they communicate in different ways than they used to. Likewise, our students use different tools and they communicate in different ways and they learn in different ways. I would start there. I would also, you know, listening to podcasts like this is really important. Just being inspired. There's something to be said for aligning your vibe with like-minded folks. And like we said, the shame and maybe the stigma of entrepreneurship in higher education is waning, but there's still vestiges of that. And you could find yourself getting stamped down pretty hard if you're in the wrong place. So you need to align with folks that have those similar types of passions and just lean into it. If you're afraid of it, it's probably something you need to run toward. That's what I've learned.
Yeah. No, great points, great takeaways. Well, Toby, I want to thank you for your time and for coming on here and, you know, enlightening our academic audience on things business and entrepreneurship. We do ask all of our guests this one final question. And that question is, if you could change one aspect of higher education, whether it be, you know, DPT or AT or otherwise, what aspect would you change and how would you change it?
I think the pace with which we move is maddening for some of us and certainly the entrepreneurs among us. The levels, I understand. I mean, especially our institution is state level. We are being stewards of the state of Texas's funds. So that needs to have checks and balances. Sometimes the red tape and the bureaucracy really can push good people away. I've been working to build this teaching and learning center for 5 years now, and I'm patient. I want it to happen. And everybody here wants it to happen as well. This is not to point a finger at any one person and say, you're not doing your job. It's just the bureaucracy. It's the nature of the system. And then likewise, you look at a private industry and, you know, they can go from idea to iteration in 3 months. What's the difference? And how could we maybe embrace some of that sleekness or that efficiency in a way that still is good stewardship for the taxpayers or for the students or for the staff and faculty? I think there's a happy medium that could be struck there that would allow us to do what we want to do on the scale that we want to do it in a much more timely fashion.
Yeah, that's a great response. I know one of the issues that we face, even if you look at the ivory tower, if you will, of academia and clinical, you're looking at 5 to 10 years before the research gets out there, right? And so like, again, like, why is this taking so long? You know, and then once we get it there, they have to pay for the articles to read them. Like, it's a broken system, man. Like, we got to figure that out. And I think I've become more patient, maybe because I've just been frustrated for so long, just kind of not giving up and giving in. But it's like you realize you do have to sit back and wait for this slow ship to kind of make its way sometimes. But I mean, again, the only way for me to really grasp and wrap my head around seeing and making and doing and being and trying to encompass that change is to be in it and try to do it from the inside, have your voice heard, you know, and That's why with regards to like APTA membership, like I've been a member for, 20 some odd years. And I think there's issues with, the American Physical Therapy Association, and I voice those, but I still pay my dues because I feel like it's the right thing to do. But the only subsection, the only academy or section that I felt like was worth anything to me was the private practice section, because they tried to operate faster, because they were a little bit different. And so that's where I've kind of put my attention and energy now, because again, I've run for positions within the APTA for, probably 7 or 8 times, and I've lost every time. And I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to keep throwing my hat in the ring because I got to try, But I feel like if we really want to see that change and speed things up, we got to be in it. We got to be trying to help push that envelope and help them from within. Yeah. At the very least, see and recognize what we're talking about. Even if you're not going to do something about it, like, at least hear us out, have a voice. And the only way you get that voice and you get a seat at the table is to throw your hat in the ring. So that, that's a great outlook and a great take on things, because again, in order to speed it up, you gotta be proactive. You gotta try to find a way to get a seat at that table so you can be heard.
We had a guest not long ago, Tim Kite, and he made a quote that really resonated with me. He said, an outcome is a trailing metric. And I guess I realized that before, but in higher ed, it's a really long trailing. So if my pass rates on my exams, first time pass rate, aren't what I want them to be, that's usually a reflection of decisions that were usually made 3 years ago. We changed the curriculum. It didn't work. You got to teach it out. So we made the decision 3 years ago. It's a 2-year program. And now we see the fruit of that decision made 3 years ago. And that's just the nature of it. It's got to go through academic affairs. It's got to be implemented. It's got to go in the catalog. There's just so many steps into that process. And then it has to be taught out. And that doesn't happen overnight either. It's 2 years before they've shown you whether or not that was a good idea. And that's tough, because in the midst of this, now I've got to figure out, okay, if they're not where I wanted them to be, if I make a change now, I'm not going to see that for 3 more years. And so, by design, it is a slow moving battleship of a thing. And whereas in business, it's like a jet ski and you're just zipping in and out and you make a decision and you can decide right away whether or not that worked. And in a lot of ways, I'm so jealous of my entrepreneur colleagues because they have agility and sleekness, and we are a much slower moving battleship of an organization.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, Toby, thank you so much again for taking time to come on and chat with us about entrepreneurship and academia. But where can people reach you or find you or get in touch with you if they have follow-up questions or they just want to see what you're up to these days?
Yeah, awesome. I appreciate the ask. The podcast is called Becoming Undone. You can find it at undonepodcast.com. It's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the major places. And then my personal website is tobyjbrooks.com. All my socials are on there. I don't do a great job of posting to the business socials, but my personal Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all that tend to be fairly regular on those outlets. So by all means, email, contact info is on there. Would love to hear. If someone's got a great story of overcoming failure and overcoming bad things or just setback in their life on to success, that's really the whole nature of the show is, sometimes in the midst of falling apart, we realize that everything fell into place, and it takes failure in order to lead us to that success.
Awesome. We'll put all those links in the show notes so people can find you very easily. Toby, thank you so much for your time, man. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Same here. Thanks, Chef Scott.
Well, I hope that episode was entertaining as much as it was informational and educational. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our past episodes, we ask you to please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating and review. And please share out the episodes to those who you feel may be able to benefit from them. We also urge you to follow us on all social media platforms at HET Podcast and let us know what topics or experts you would like to hear from in future episodes. And just as a reminder, none of the information on today's show should be considered medical advice. It's simply infotainment or edutainment to help educate our audience. For medical advice, we always advise you to reach out to your preferred medical professionals, and we'll see you on the next show.